Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Neil Jordan, whose latest novel is Shade. Earlier books include Sunrise with Sea Monsters, Dream of a Beast, a collection of short stories, Night in Tunisia, and The Past. Neil Jordan is also the director of several films, including The Crying Game, for which he also wrote the screenplay, Good Thief, High Spirits, Interview with the Vampire, Michael Collins, Butcher Boy, End of the Affair, In Dreams, Where No Angels, and coming up, Breakfast on Pluto, which is based on a Patrick McCabe novel, as was Butcher Boy.
Yeah.
Neil Jordan, you began as a writer. You were actually on a career as a writer when somehow you wound up with John Borman working on Excalibur.
Yeah. Well, I started writing stories, short stories. I began writing stuff for television and screenplays, and there was no film industry in Ireland, and I found it absolutely compulsive. Just the story in visual terms, I found it really exciting. John Borman was doing Excalibur, and he had read some of my work. He asked me to collaborate on a script with him, which I did, which was never made. And then he was making this movie. He asked me to go through the last draft of the script with him, basically. That's how it happened. And he was running the National Film Studios out in Bray at the time.
There was a jump from there to working on your first film, which was Angel. How did that come about?
Again, I wrote a script, you know, sent it to Channel 4, which had just opened up in England, which was a TV station that wanted to put finance into movies. And they liked it a lot, and they asked me who thought would be an appropriate director, and I said myself, you know, and they went, no. But eventually I persuaded them to let me do it.
Had you known Stephen Rea at all?
No. Well, I knew him from the theatre. Basically, I spoke to him, you know, I kind of wrote that movie with him in mind. He was from the north of Ireland. At the time, I used to play the saxophone in a band. You know, it kind of merged some of my own experiences with the story of the broader things that were going on at the time.
Looking at Shade and at all of your films, there's several threads that run through them. And one is, of course, the Irish thread. And Shade joins several other Irish novels. There's an entire Irish literature out there. There isn't that much of a Irish film history that at least we know about here.
Yeah, no, there's none, basically. To say there's none, you know, a lot of film historians would take exception to that. There's a tradition of international production being made there. There was a film made in around 1920, 22 maybe, about the War of Independence called The Dawn. There was some silent movie making that went on there during the 40s and 50s when the Abbey Theatre was a national institution. They made a series of filmed plays, really. But this has not been until the 80s. There's no industry there at all. There's no tradition of filmmaking there at all. Which is why I found it so exciting, really, because it was like putting your feet on a beach that nobody had walked on before, you know? Okay.
Well, there's a little of that feel in Shade, in which the main character, who's an actress, gets involved in film and in theater in the period prior to and just after the First World War.
Yeah. Well, she goes to England. She's thrown out of her house because she has a forced abortion. And she goes on a cattle boat to England, and she ends up with a theatre troupe there. It was quite interesting doing that, actually, because I took a break from making films to write this book. Anybody who's a filmmaker, you go through periods of absolute optimism as to what the medium can do and absolute nausea of what it does do, you know, the kind of thing. So I took time off to write this book, and as I began to write the sections where she was in she goes to some of the early silent movie studios in Limehouse and in London and down in the south of England, a real hatred of the movie-making process emerged in the writing. And it really shocked me, you know, how she regarded it as a kind of an invasive, kind of corrosive kind of poison that was invading her in some way, you know. I don't know where that came from, but anyway.
Well, that's one thing about writing, is that it can bring out all kinds of things from the writer.
I know, but I had no idea. There was something deep inside me regarded something in the movie-making process as innately corrupting, you know, which shocked me.
Neil Jordan, having written four novels and short stories, is the research that you do different for writing a novel than when you're doing the preliminary work on a screenplay or working on the actual film, or is there a similarity?
No, it's absolutely similar. I mean, if this is set, I decided eventually, after I'd gone through several drafts, to set it in the period 1900 to 1950. I read everything I could about the period, but it's exactly the same if you're making a film set in any period, you know. If you're doing a film of the 18th century, and, you know, you get out all the books on architecture and you begin to research it and you begin to just try and fill your mind with a world that doesn't exist anymore. So that's what I did on that.
When you're composing a screenplay or working on shaping a screenplay for your own directorial ends, Is that process similar or different than the process in writing this? I noticed that in Shade and also in Sunrise with Sea Monsters, you're dealing mainly with flashbacks.
You mean I'm dealing with memory? So that's not a movie technique at all. That's the thing films do worst. They're more about what happens, aren't they? It's why it's essentially a literary technique that's transposed to movies, isn't it? Somebody sitting there, well, son, all those years ago when your mother and I, before she was your mother, you know, or whatever, you know, this kind of thing. You ask me, do they inform each other? Are they different? Not in my mind, but obviously they must in some way, you know, because there's a lot of visual description in that book. It's almost like the element of visual description is to the forefront of the book in many ways, you know, so that must come from the fact that I make films as well.
I think as a filmmaker, you're seeing things visually in your head anyway.
You have to, yeah.
When you're working on a book, however, you're doing it solo. You're not working in collaboration with anybody else. And that
No. It's a totally different process, but the difference is really that you can know what's wrong with a screenplay. You know, you can know what's wrong with a movie. Even as you think, you can think, okay, I want to do this, and it starts in Las Vegas, say, for example. You know, say it starts with a thief, yeah? And he's co-opted by the CIA, yeah, because he knows how to break into strange safes, so they bring him to Afghanistan. And then what? Do you understand what I mean? But there's an obvious problem to examine. There's a what to be explored. Whereas with a book, when you start it, you don't even know where it's going. Sometimes you don't even know what it's about. Sometimes you don't even know where it's set, you know, that kind of thing. In this case, all I had was the beginnings of a story. And with this, I had the image of this woman when she was dead, finding out that she actually was her own ghost, you know, that she was her own imaginary friend when she was a child. That was the act of her looking at herself. That's the only thing I started with, and a sense of a voice of this woman. So it's a much more interior process, and it's a much more, it's like floundering through. I hope the experience of reading it isn't like that.
Do you do your own editing on your films? Do you stand over an editor?
Yeah, no, I work with an editor, Tony Lawson, yeah. I don't stand over them, no, but we work together, you know, we go through every take.
So to that degree, when you're shaping the book after the first draft, you're doing something like that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But it's more a matter of finding out what the book wants to be than anything else. It's actually more a matter of finding out, do these characters have any life in them, you know what I mean? Is there anywhere for them to go? I mean, you can start with many conceptions of a project, you know, and they can be stillborn, you know what I mean? They just don't turn out to be fruitful.
Well, the book itself, this woman has died, and we go back in time and we learn how she grew up, how she became an actress. There's a long section in which you cross-cut between her growing acting career and these two men who are sent off to Turkey to fight World War I.
Yeah, they're sent to Gallipoli, yeah.
Was there a special Irish contingent over there?
Irish regiment, yeah. It was called the 10th Irish Division. They merged all the Irish, the traditional Irish regiments in the British Army, like the Royal Irish, the Dublin Fusiliers. I hadn't realized when I began to research this, I thought the big Irish experience in the First World War, I thought it was in Europe, in the Somme, Flanders and all that sort of stuff. And I thought the Gallipoli experience was, I thought it was entirely peopled by the Anzacs, you know, by Australians and New Zealanders. But actually there was a huge contingent of Irish soldiers who went there and who were killed there, you know. So, I mean, but the one thing I wanted this book to be kind of, because the family, Nina's family were Catholic and they were wealthy, yeah? And so I wanted to give a portrait. I began to read a lot of memoirs at the time. And because I've written several novels and made Michael Collins, for example, that dealt with the War of Independence, it was amazing to find these swathes of Irish life that were totally untouched by that experience, you know, by the revolutionary kind of experience. And that's what I wanted to portray in this. And it was quite interesting doing that because there's an idyll that kept going unbroken in a strange way, you know, a way of life that kind of wasn't interrupted but just gently rotted over the succeeding decades. You know?
Neil Jordan, it sounds to me from what you're saying about Shade and from seeing films like Michael Collins or even The Crying Game or any more contemporary material you've done on Ireland, that each time you kind of open up a new door because Ireland has so many areas to be explored.
I've written a novel, The Past, about the period from 1920 to 1935. I've written Sunrise with Sea Monster, was about the 40s, basically. You know, this is 1900 to 1950s. Michael Collins was about 1922. I don't know, they're all roughly around the same. And the movies I've made about, you know, the conflict there are about my direct experience, my generation's experience of that kind of thing. They're all trying to understand the same issues which, you know, were around when I was a kid and were not very well. They weren't very clearly articulated.
I could not tell about the relationship of where the book takes place in terms of Northern or Southern Ireland?
Oh, it's Southern Ireland. It's Drogheda.
Okay.
To the mouth of the Boyne River, which, you know, was, at the period, would have just been part of the United Kingdom. But when the Revolution or the War of Independence happened, it would have been part of the South, yeah. Well, the nice thing is that these facts hardly affect the protagonists at all, you know.
Neil Jordan, in Shade, there's this huge section that takes place in World War One, and I'm wondering, here we are in America dealing with this insane war in Iraq. One would think that, obviously, the Bush people might say that it's all about World War II and fighting the good fight, and people here say we're in a mire and it's like Vietnam. But it seems that people are going back, and if they're thinking about it, and I don't know if this was conscious enough, they're thinking more about World War I.
Yeah, they are, because, frankly, that was a war that the entire world drifted into a state of war without the specific volition of any one party, it seemed. And actually, if you look at Iraq, there's two things I would compare it to. One is the attempt to force the Dardanelles by Winston Churchill. Yeah, to open a theatre, an absolute irrelevance to the main area of conflict, which was in Europe, you know. Similarly with George Bush's incursion into Iraq. It seemed to me to have absolutely nothing to do with whatever he was fighting in Afghanistan, you know. And the other is Napoleon's Spanish campaign, which nobody ever talks about, you know, or which Napoleon didn't even talk about, because the Grand Army was kind of butchered in Spain when they went there. The parallels with Iraq are absolutely fascinating, because Napoleon was going through Europe as a liberator, you know, deposing kings and blah, blah, blah. And apparently, in theory, you know, the populations were welcoming him with open arms. But when he went to Spain, he encountered a far more ancient and a culture he knew absolutely nothing about. And he put his brother in charge of the armies there, and they were just like, over a period of 4 years, they were decimated, they were savaged. So I don't approve of the war in Iraq. And what I find really shocking is the commentary on American television is quite shocking in its obtuseness and its deliberate opacity, you know what I mean?
When you go back to Ireland, what is the general response?
For the next 4 years, I mean, it's like those of us who live in Europe would just say bye-bye for a while, I think. You know, it seems America's gone in a different direction, hasn't it, radically?
Neil Jordan, looking at your career as a filmmaker, there's a distinct division between what might be called today independent films, smaller films, and films made in the Hollywood system. The Crying Game, Angel, Company of Wolves, Mona Lisa are all smaller films, I assume, and Butcher Boy, and I assume Breakfast in Pluto is as well. And then you have more Hollywood films, Interview with a Vampire, End of the Affair, In Dreams, High Spirits, I guess. How different is the work between those two sets of films when you're dealing with them?
Well, it's kind of a paradox, because Michael Collins and The Butcher Boy were made by Warner Brothers, and Interview the Vampire obviously was a big Hollywood movie, and End of the Affair seems to me like an independent movie that was made for Sony. It's really hard to work out. I mean, I draw the distinction really between films that I've written and films that I haven't.
You wrote Crying Game?
Yeah, I wrote The Crying Game. Actually, I wrote them all. No, I didn't write In Dreams. That was written by Bruce Robinson. That was a story that Steven Spielberg had commissioned from Bruce Robinson that he intended to direct himself at one stage. I didn't write We're No Angels. That was written by David Mamet. So that is the distinction I would draw, basically, yeah.
High Spirits has an interesting pedigree, which is that it's considered now a lost movie in that the original director's cut was taken away from you and it was recut in a way that didn't seem to work. Does the original director's cut exist somewhere?
No, it doesn't. Well, it exists in a vault at Shepperton. They kind of took over the process of... at no stage did I ever sit down and watch the entire film that I'd shot. They previewed it when it was... half of the effects were not composited, so they previewed it with great swathes of blue screen. The results went obviously badly from their point of view, so they began to recut it at that stage. I actually met Pauline Kael actually at the time, and she asked me, did a director's cut exist? I said it didn't, so I went back to Shepperton, and I hired an editor to try and cut it together again, but they hadn't been paid, you know, so they wouldn't release the film from the vaults, yeah. Well, it was kind of a distressing experience.
If a director's cut were going to be created at this
point, I'd have to recut it.
From the beginning. Do you have any interest in doing something like that?
I'd love to see it at some stage. I'd love to see what I actually shot, you know what I mean? Because it's what I shot was not what ended up on the screen. Yeah, I'd love to see it, because it was conceived as a kind of a necrophiliac comedy, you know, where a bunch of dead people fell in love with a bunch of living people, and that's not quite the movie that...
The Crying Game, how did you find Jay Davidson?
Found him in a club in London, through Derek Jarman, actually. He's a filmmaker who's sadly dead now.
Sure, good filmmaker.
Very good, yeah. we were trying to find a boy who could believably be a woman for half the picture. He knew the London club scene, and he mentioned this young kid that he'd met. I met Jay and tested him. He was actually remarkable, but he was the only person I'd met who could even approach the illusion of the part, you know, so I cast him, yeah.
It's kind of interesting. Some people I know, the first time I saw him on screen, I said, oh, that's a guy. But
well,
a lot of people did not.
A lot of people did not know. No, I know that, yeah. And in a way, it didn't matter. I mean, if you knew he was a guy, still the central character doesn't know he's a guy. It only matters if there is a big secret, you know? So you go, aha, I know the secret. But that was a marketing thing, wasn't it, the secret?
That movie just took off. Were you shocked?
No. I mean, I was surprised and I was gladdened, really. I was kind of just thrilled to have a film out that was intact, that hadn't been, you know, recut by some demented nutcase, you know, and that actually audiences were going to see. I was very happy.
One of the criticisms of the film is that it put the IRA in a more positive light.
Yeah. Well, the IRA wouldn't say that, actually. I mean, look at the DVD. Somebody's done a load of interviews with ex-veterans, and they took great exception to their portrayal in that film, you know. They thought they were portrayed as psychopaths, you know. I think the criticism was that it showed somebody who was a member of the IRA having a crisis of conscience and changing in midstream. That's what people objected to. They objected to the fact that you could show a human dimension to people who terrorize people.
Well, that brings up that distinction between the difference between a terrorist, a freedom fighter, you know, a member of the resistance. I mean, that's always going to come up.
And I think a point came in the Irish experience where there was no freedom fighting element to what you would define as a terrorist. A point came where it was just pure, unconscionable misuse of history and politics, and it was kind of a moral blot in the landscape, really. You know, it kind of had to go.
Neil Jordan, working with Patrick McCabe, I've interviewed him a couple of times.
Oh, have you?
Yeah. Yeah. How do you find it easy or difficult to translate that? I mean, I could see The Butcher Boy, which is a fairly straightforward book, being translated, but Breakfast on Pluto is not.
No, it's not, no. Well, it's going to say, the titles of the film are going to go, Breakfast on Pluto, marginally based on the novel by Patrick McCabe. Or as Pat says, it'll go, Breakfast on Pluto, sweet fuck all to do with the novel by Pat McCabe. Can I say that? I'm sorry for saying that. But that's what McCabe suggested. Because I kind of took it as a riff. I kind of took it as a place to start and began to expand and expand. I always had the feeling that Pat had never finished the book. Now, I've said this to him when we've been out drinking sometimes, you know, and he would disagree with me, but I always had a sneaking suspicion that the book was a series of sketches.
Yeah.
So when we began to do the screenplay, I took the characters absolutely, you know, with much more seriousness than he did, and I brought them to different areas and stuff like that. And he was thrilled. He was kind of shocked but thrilled at the same time, you know. So the film is quite a different animal to the book.
I don't recall there being that much of a through story in the. There's a little bit.
The basic situation is a transvestite son of a priest who goes to London trying to find his mother, basically. But Pat never took the search for the mother seriously, did he? You know, once he goes to London, he gets involved in all these adventures and he talks to a psychiatrist and stuff. Whereas once you take that search for the mother absolutely seriously, it becomes quite a poignant and, you know, very affecting story, you know.
When you're working on Interview with a Vampire, I found it to be remarkably close to the book.
Mm.
What kind of control did you have over that? Or were you kind of a director for hire on that?
No, I had. I made that like an independent film.
Okay.
It was strange. It was through the good graces of David Geffen, basically. The Crying Game had come out being a big hit, and he sent me this book, which I had not read. I'd heard about it, but I hadn't read it. And I read it on a plane to Paris. I thought the book was remarkable. It was also definitely a generic piece, you know, so it was suitable, ripe for making it into a film, obviously.
Right.
But And Anne had written a script, which I read, which was kind of like a writer's version of a script, you know, that kind of thing. So I said to David, okay, give me a month or so, I'll rewrite the script, and, you know, I'll use her script and go back to the book. And so I used her script and went back and made it much more faithful to the novel, actually, than she had been in a way. And I gave it to the guys at Warner Brothers, and they all said, okay, let's make the film. For some reason, I was making, you know, an $80 to $100 million movie, and nobody touched me, you know, so nobody said boo to me. I suppose if the film hadn't worked out well, you know, if we'd previewed it and it had been a disaster, they would have been all over it, but it thankfully didn't work out that way, you know.
How did you feel in the end about Pitt and Cruise and Banderas?
Oh, I thought they were great, yeah. I thought Tom Cruise was great, I thought Brad was great, you know, so. They had a lot of criticism, didn't they, public criticism, but you know, Tom Cruise, he's a great star, and I always felt these vampires should be stars, you know. They should be almost too real, you know, in a strange way. The fault of the movie, actually, is that it's too faithful to the book. You know, I mean, as a film, it is a kind of a, it's a wandering, the narrative wanders. It wanders through time with these guys pitching through centuries, really, and that is the fault. In a way, to solve that, I would have had to be far less faithful to the book than I was, you know.
And you were also dealing with the Rice fans who would have come down on your
head.
Yeah,
no, but
did
I didn't
that.
Mind that. I wanted to make the book, you know what
right.
I mean? I mean, I knew that was definitely a kind of a, it's a slack element in a horror movie, which should be propulsive and terrifying, you know what I mean? So the terror has gone out of it if the narrative has this kind of picaresque element to it, you know. But still, that was the book, you know what I mean? And that was what the book was about. The book was about how this guy suffers eternity once he's been made a vampire and he has to suffer it, you know. So I was glad to have been that faithful to it.
It was strange for me because watching it, I realized that the only two movies I'd ever seen that were that faithful to books I'd already read were Maltese Falcon and Gone with the Wind.
Hammett kind of went straight onto the screen, really, didn't he? I did a version of Red Harvest years ago for a film that was never made, and it was
really?
Kind of similar. Yeah, that novel just kind of jumped from the page.
What happened to a film called Me and My Monster?
That's still there. Waiting, they want me to make it, I think.
What is it?
It's a story about a kid who is in a circus. He's got a very unsympathetic father, and his mother is the tattooed lady in the circus. And he's playing. His only friend there is a fire eater called Joe. Yeah, and he's trying to learn on his own how to blow fire out of his mouth. He burns the circus down. They have to move to a suburb. And he's very unhappy there, and he finds this creature in a swamp, which is like, he doesn't have a name for it, and he looks up all these mythological fairy books, and he hides it, yeah? And he managed to hide it from, you know, the school and all that sort of stuff, and his parents and all that. But this thing grows up with him, so when he's 12, this thing is about 8 foot tall, you know? And when he's an adult, it's the size of King Kong, and he can't get rid of it because it's attached to him, you know? So it's a beautiful fantasy, but it's kind of a mixture between King Kong and a Lewis Carroll story or something. It's quite lovely, but it's very expensive. I was working with Stan Winston on it last year, and for various reasons, among them illness, we had to put it back.
Is that set in Ireland? Or?
Oh, no, it's set in New Orleans and, you know, wretched suburbs of the northeastern seaboard.
Neil Jordan, when you're dealing with films, do you ever contemplate the relationship of the political element or how a film affects the world politically when you're doing it, or do you try to put that aside as much as you can?
No. I mean, I don't make directly political movies, though I have to say that having made Michael Collins in Ireland at the time, that was as explosive a political situation I've ever been in, you know, because that movie got right into the middle of the argument between the kind of provisional IRA and the reference to disband and those who thought they should never have been there and all that sort of stuff.
There was a lot of criticism about the portrayal of De Valera.
There was. There was a lot of criticism about a lot of things, actually. I had to write letters to the OUC Disabled Officers Association because they took offense at the fact that they used a car bomb in the movie in a way they thought was inappropriate, you know. So that movie kind of hit a lot of nerves in Ireland. It hit a lot of political nerves, which was what was good about it because it was obviously addressing a situation that was still very raw. I mean, that's the kind of ways in which the films I've made have impinged on politics. I mean, I've never made anything like the Battle of Algiers or, for example, those kind of movies they used to make in the 70s, you know, about nuclear power issues and stuff like that, you know.
There are issues that pop up in several of your movies, of course.
That's because of my experience. That's because of the generation, the period I've grown up in Ireland when political violence was, you know, was a fact for everybody, you know.
Neil Jordan, how was it like working with David Mamet on Where No Angels?
I didn't work with him at all, basically.
Really?
No, not at all, no. I mean, I was sent a screenplay. I was in Shepperton Studios, and I read the screenplay. I thought I really liked it, actually. You know, it seemed like everything a Hollywood screenplay should be. And I suggested a few changes. I broadened it out in some portions. We met 2 or 3 times, and he was teaching in Boston at the time. But that was it, really. You know, then I went off with Robert De Niro and Sean Penn to make a movie, really. You know, so we didn't have much of a collaboration, really. Then he saw the movie and he liked it a lot.
Well, when you're dealing with actors of the caliber of Penn and De Niro, how much free rein do you give them, or is it the same amount you'd give to Cruise or Pitt or
Well, no,
Stephen Ray?
That's I suppose that's the difference from being a director for hire or somebody who's written their own script. I mean, on that movie, that's the only film I've really done as a director. I did find it odd, the presumptions of what a director's function was. Hollywood seems to presume the director's job is more like a diplomat, basically, you know. to oversee and to manage the personalities in the film and to make something that works, that kind of thing. You know, as whereas I would regard my job as being the one, you know, just defining every aspect of the movie, really. So it was, I mean, we had a good time in that film, but actually anybody who puts David Mamet and myself and Robert De Niro and Sean Penn in something that's meant to be a light comedy has chosen the wrong group of people, I think, don't you?
Neil Jordan, if you're looking at all of your films, which film do you think you made that is the most successful in terms of the vision that you were trying to achieve?
I'd have to say, because it's very hard to differentiate the pressure under which things are made, you know, and the end result, you know. And a lot of films I've made under extreme poverty-stricken conditions. For example, like Mona Lisa.
Right.
I mean, that was really, that we really had so little money with which to make that movie. But I think actually it has a very, the kind of emotional and visual texture of it seemed very, very complete in a strange way, you know. I mean, the films that I've made where I was absolutely able to do everything I needed to do because I had the resources to do them were, I would say, Michael Collins, The Butcher Boy, The End of the Affair, you know. Perhaps The Butcher Boy and The End of the Affair were small, kind of small-scale films for which I had a comfortable budget and I was able to realize them properly, you know what I mean? The Crying Game was made with chewing gum, basically. And, you know, I mean, I love the movie, but, you know, even though we shot it on CinemaScope, you know, there are portions of the film where, you know, I was kind of almost holding up the dolly myself, you know, the kind of thing. The thing is, with DVD, one has to look at one's things again because you have to do the commentaries and all
right.
that. And what amazes me is how complete a picture every movie gives of the person that I was at the time, you know, and I find that shocking because I kept thinking when I was making these films I was concealing my intentions, you know what I mean, and concealing myself somehow. But they're so revealing, all sorts of odd things, you know, that it's, you know, I find it quite shocking.
Neil Jordan, in a number of your works, there's this underlying fantasy element. How
yeah.
conscious is that when you bring it in?
It just kind of emerges. I like to push stories to places that are kind of unreal, to elements that approximate to fairy tales. I love to do that kind of thing. I'm not sure audiences often love it. For example, in Breakfast and Pluto, the whole structure of the movie is pivoted around a series of fantasies, you know, which are, I think they're quite effective and funny at the same time, you know. I mean, I like to counterpoint the real and the absolutely unreal, you know, because I don't think the real world is that real anyway.
So coming up, we have Me and My Monster after you finished Breakfast on Pluto, hopefully. You have any other works?
I wrote a movie about the Borgia papacy, Lucretia and Rodrigo and Cesare Borgia, which was too expensive to get going a couple of years ago. That, of all things, I would love to do, because that's one of those absolutely perfect metaphors for the current climate, you know what I mean?
You've been listening to an interview with Neil Jordan, whose latest novel is Shade. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.